Welcome to this week's America Podcast. I'm Associate Editor Luke Hansen. In September, I participated in a delegation to Honduras. The eight of us represented Jesuit ministries in the United States and Canada. I write about the experience in the February 8th issue of America. Today I'm joined by Shana Aber, Policy Director of the U.S. Jesuits Office of Social and International Ministries. Shana helped lead the delegation. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm interested in how you became involved in Central American issues. What's your background that helped lead to this delegation in Honduras?
The answer to that is kind of twofold. I worked for a number of years for Jesuit Refugee Service, focusing on issues arising in Latin America and focusing primarily on Colombian displacement issues. And I found, as I started to do a little bit more investigation of the current situation in Honduras, many similarities between Colombia, which has struggled for years both with endemic violence and poverty and inequality, and with the drug trade, which kind of continues to fuel that violence. I noticed many similarities between the Colombia crisis, which has gone on for some 50 years, and the current situation in Honduras, which really is something that began about five or six years ago.
Can you help? Yeah, set the context for what's happening in Honduras right now by talking about the military coup that happened in June of 2009, where President Zelaya was deposed. And how did that affect the country, and sort of what have been the main things that have happened since then?
So if I could just go back, I got involved in Honduras because of my work with the Jesuits here in the U.S. Right now I'm the policy director at the National Advocacy Office of the Jesuits, which, as you know, is called the Office of Social and International Ministries at the Jesuit Conference. And we actually had the opportunity to meet Father Melo, Padre Melo, as he's known, in Honduras, in July of 2012, when he came up to testify before a committee of Congress, the Tom Lantos Human Rights Commission, about the challenges facing Honduras in terms of protecting freedom of the press. As he testified at that hearing, about 30 journalists have been killed since the coup. I had the chance just to meet him briefly while he was up, and then 2 weeks later, we actually received word that the Jesuit radio station down in Honduras had been basically invaded by police. And it was kind of a very scary situation in which the police had found out that the other social ministry of the Jesuits in Honduras, in Progreso, called ERIC, was giving a seminar to campesinos, to peasant farmers, so that they could understand their rights and understand how to do community organizing and the like. And the police got confused and thought that the radio station was giving the seminar, and so stormed the radio offices and took pictures of the employees and were saying, "Where are the campesinos? Where are the campesinos?" And so that was actually kind of when I started really focusing on and paying attention to what was going on, because that was kind of a scary situation, reminiscent in certain ways of the aggressive way in which military acted in Honduras and in Central America and El Salvador and Nicaragua during the 80s and 70s and kind of the lead up to all of the wars in Central America. So that kind of spurred us to start to get in better touch with the Jesuits down in Honduras. And what we found was that a lot of the Jesuits who are actually Missouri Province Jesuits who are living down in Honduras were also voicing their extreme concern about the levels of violence in the country. We're basically saying, you know, we wake up to bodies every morning who have been gunned down during the night. We've never seen the country like this in 40 years of being in Honduras. Then we also heard from Jesuits on the border, Jesuits who have worked in detention ministry on the border, Jesuits who have worked to serve the needs of migrants traveling north or after they were deported back to Mexico. And those Jesuits were saying, we're seeing more and more Honduran kids, Honduran youth, saying that they're fleeing because of the levels of violence. So you asked me about the coup of 2009, and the way that the country changed after the coup, I think it wasn't, I don't think that you can blame the coup and the coup alone for the destabilizing of the institutions in Honduras. If you look at the murder rates in Central America in general, they've been on the rise. Guatemala, El Salvador, both have rising murder rates that are very much linked to the drug trade, drug trafficking through those countries, and to gang-related violence. What happened in Honduras is that general trend in the region was the undercurrent, and then the coup happened, and almost all bets were off, I would say. It was like the rules of the game completely changed. People who are very powerful people in Honduras, very wealthy people in Honduras, used the chaos created by the coup to start to seize land and other resources that they wanted to exploit. And they knew that the coup government was not going to hold them accountable. So the levels of impunity in the country rose very dramatically. And at the same time, in response to the violence from the gangs and the drug traffickers, what we saw was real concerted effort to put a lot of energy, a lot of resources into the security apparatus. And so what we then saw in 2010, 2011, 2012 was the real militarization of Honduran society. And that obviously also brings with it a number of challenges, including basically lack of accountability. When you're using a military apparatus or a militarized police force to do what basically should be civilian duties, civilians often have their rights violated. People are not able to hold their leaders accountable. And what we also found in the years after the coup is that a lot of private companies and multinational companies have actually hired their own private security forces, which have acted in many ways in, as paid mercenaries for powerful people, carrying out their own form of law enforcement or kind of subverting the laws in order to meet the needs of these powerful entities.
So the people who participated in the delegation represented Jesuit ministries in the United States and Canada, and a major part of the week was meeting Jesuits and visiting Jesuit apostolates in the country. So what did you see in those places, and what did you learn about the response of the Catholic Church in Honduras to these realities that the country is facing right now?
So Honduras is the most unequal country in Spanish-speaking Latin America. It's only behind Haiti for the hemisphere in terms of its inequality index. And what does that mean in reality? It means vast amounts of unemployment and underemployment, real struggles with poverty, which has led to a lot of historic migration. One of the things that struck me the first night that we were in Honduras, we went to a theater program of the Jesuits. It's called the Fuego. What is it called? Fragua? And it's run by a Jesuit from the Missouri province who's been down there for a while. And it's supposed to spur discussion among community members. It's very community participative. And the focus of the theatrical production we saw was migration. And migration is a reality that permeates Honduras. People are migrating both because of joblessness, but also because of real fear that their country is collapsing and that their lives are in danger. Recent article in The Economist pointed out that with the murder rates being what they are, one, if you're a young man between 14 and 30 in Honduras, you have a 1 in 300 chance of being murdered. So that's really dramatic. And these are the realities that we're facing, and these are the realities that the church is confronting as well. I talked in last summer with the executive secretary of Caritas for Honduras, Herman Caliz, who's a priest down there, and he said in no uncertain terms, you know, we're talking about a crisis situation, an emergency situation, and the church obviously is addressing this in a number of ways. The way that the Jesuits are addressing it, I think, is really seeking to build senses of community and to strengthen the institution of the church, in the sense of community, and also looking to give people the tools they need in order to be empowered advocates in their own right to hold their government institutions accountable. They also, the church also has been engaged in trying to obviously fight the root causes, talk about poverty, talking about the vast amounts of inequality in the country as unsustainable and at the root of a lot of the violence. I was also really impressed with some of the work that a bishop in La Ceiba has done, standing with communities that have been threatened by mining projects, because this one community we visited is certainly not the lone example of communities that have had their rights violated, their families threatened because they've failed to sell their land to multinational companies. And the church has been a really strong voice in that conflict, standing with the people who are just seeking justice, really. I think, though, if I'm going to be frank, that far, far more needs to be done, and that the church can do more, and the global church can do more, especially. I was talking to one of the Jesuits who lives in a very poor region in Honduras, Father Colato, and he said that there used to be delegations that came down from various dioceses in the U.S., to do, dental work or specialty cardiac work or, health delegations, basically, that came down from the U.S., housing delegations that came down from the U.S. Basically, he said that the health sector was being propped up by these kind of visits and also by Peace Corps and as was the education sector. Unfortunately, I think because of the murder rate, because of the real dramatic violence that we've seen over the last few years, churches in the U.S. who partnered so heavily with churches in Honduras have pulled back a lot. And that has had a real kind of compounding effect in terms of lack of resources for the poor in Honduras.
So you've described the response of the church and what more the church could do, and it's very much happening at a grassroots level right now. But Honduras just had national elections in November, and the incumbent party won. And what are the implications of those elections, and is there any hope that, that party is going to be held accountable and that anything might change? What's your take on the political situation in the country right now?
So unfortunately, the man who won, Juan Orlando Hernandez, is someone who we already know kind of what direction he wants to bring the country. He was the president of the Congress over the last few years, and it was under his administration or his kind of leadership that the Congress put forth a number of proposals aimed at making the country more militarized, more authoritarian. They passed this military police law back in September, which aims to put military units in the streets with the police, supposedly to curb drug trafficking. But we've already seen the effects of the military police as they were rolled out in San Pedro Sula and Tegucigalpa. And there have been a number of concerns about the way that they have been interacting with civilians and especially kind of just extrajudicial executions and other concerns that we've had about the military police. They also have redefined what it means to be a terrorist. If you get in the way of capital, basically, then you could be considered a terrorist under the military police law. It was also under his leadership that the Congress passed a law called the Ciudades Modelos Law, or the Charter Cities Law. And this law allows Honduras to sell pieces of Honduras to private entities, private companies, and those companies would then be able to suspend the constitution of Honduras and have tax-free zones, hire their own police, hire their own private kind of administrators. And what we see this as is like a real means to, again, consolidate territory, beautiful territory, you know, viable territory into the hands of the few and leave the many in a situation where they neither have the resources nor the ability to address the continued violence in the country. That law actually was ruled unconstitutional at the end of 2012. And the response of Juan Orlando Hernandez to the fact that the Supreme Court found the law unconstitutional was to lead an effort to fire four Supreme Court justices. And he actually was successful in that. And so now the law, with a few tweaks, will be rolling out. He also spearheaded the new mining law, which allows for open pit mining, allows companies to do their own environmental assessments of the damage with no third-party audit, and basically allows, again, for high levels of impunity by multinational companies. So what does this election mean? I don't think it's good news in terms of building a accountable, transparent democracy in Honduras. There were a lot of allegations of irregularities, I think, at this point. The way that that we hope the country will move forward is that the Congress, that some kind of congressional pact will be made that will allow for the opposition parties in the Congress to also have their say. And there were a number of delegates elected from some of the non-traditional parties to the National Assembly, including from the Anti-Corruption Party, from the Libre Party, which was the party of the ousted president, who was ousted in 2009, and from the Liberal Party. So if those three parties can somehow get together and form a coalition in Congress and challenge some of the policies that the National Party has been putting forward, I think that perhaps we do have a counterweight and a balance that could come about. And I think that's what we kind of have to bank on. Another thing that I'm really hoping to see, because all of the presidential candidates promised that they would take this seriously, is some more energy put into the police reform process. The police are everyone agrees, I think, from the far right to the far left in Honduras, that the police are riddled with corruption, are basically bought and paid for by drug traffickers and other unsavory characters in the country. And they really do have to address both the lack of independence of the judiciary and the corruption in the police, and also address the need for the institutions that monitor the police, the institutions that can hold the police accountable, to have independent investigations. There was a really great report that Caritas published back in June that was actually authored by the chief human rights officer at the Jesuit Social Center, Eric, that specifically put forth the fact that the public prosecutor for human rights actually could be an office that's strengthened and made independent, and that there are people of goodwill working within that office. And they, you know, basically cataloged all of the ways in which the office in its current configuration is deficient, and said, you know, if you can put more resources in this and you can make sure that they have their own investigators, not police, to investigate charges of police abuse, then this institution could actually play a role in kind of being an ombudsman that would be able to hold government officials that that abuse their power accountable. Now, unfortunately, since that report was filed and since a new public general prosecutor was, or AG rather, was appointed, the people who were inside that agency when Eric did the audit have all been transferred. And that seems a very deliberate move. There were 17 public prosecutors transferred, and they all were from the anti-corruption public prosecutor's office and the human rights public prosecutor's office. And that happened right before the election in November. So that wasn't good news. But what it still tells us is that there has to be a way out of this morass. There has to be a way in which government institutions and civil society can address the rise in violence and the rise in government corruption and abuse.
I'd like to close by asking about the role of the United States in all this. And, you know, the delegation went to the U.S. Embassy, Tegucigalpa, at the end of the week, and we met with human rights officials there. So I'd like to ask about how that meeting went, you know, what you see as the role of the embassy and how they can play a constructive role in addressing some of these issues, and, you know, what Americans can do from home to take an active role in promoting justice in the country.
So, unfortunately, our country has a very messy history in Honduras. And so sometimes the U.S. is not the country best placed to address issues of violence and human rights abuse. The U.S. actually used Honduras as a training ground for the Contras during the wars in El Salvador and Nicaragua and Guatemala. And because of that history, there's kind of a general feeling of distrust about the motivations behind the U.S. diplomatic mission down in Honduras. I think the meeting that we had was enlightening, in part because one of the officials in the embassy was very frank about what he saw as U.S. interest in Honduras. And he named those three things as keeping drugs from coming north into the U.S., 80% of the drugs that arrive in the U.S. pass through Honduras. Number two, keeping people from migrating irregularly over our border who come from Honduras. And number three, opening up Honduran markets so that they can consume more U.S. goods and create more jobs back in the U.S. Of course, from the perspective of Catholic social teaching, we try not to instrumentalize people for our own ends, but it's interesting to hear that kind of frank accounting by a U.S. government official of the U.S. priorities in Honduras. Particularly interesting after, I think, visiting communities throughout Honduras and hearing about the crippling levels of violence and poverty. One thing that I would challenge our government to do is to think about those three aims as only being satisfied if we are able to address poverty in Honduras, because poverty has fed the violence, which has in turn fed the high levels of corruption and the instability of institutions and the rampant impunity.
I've been speaking with Shana Aber, who is the policy director of the U.S. Jesuits Office of Social and International Ministries. Shana, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.